Okay, welcome once again to Power, Truth, and Suffering, Great Stories of the Mishnah and Talmud. We're now at Lecture 3, The Oven of Achnai, or Heaven Hath No Fury Like a Rabbi Spurned. Before starting, I'd just like to ask that you not scroll the texts that will be in front of you, not play with the scrolling or the magnification of them, because it will affect everyone's screen. Then I'll have to read back and play with it. Okay. Now, the story of the Oven of Achnai is extremely well known. It's perhaps the most taught, read, studied, written about story in the entire Babylonian Talmud. But I think often, most of the time, the story is not really understood properly. And the reason why is that people stop teaching or telling the story in the middle, and they don't read the whole story, and they don't see the entire context of what this story is trying to get at. It's seen primarily as a story about theology, about the nature of God's relationship with man. And generally speaking, people stop the story at one of the high points where Yeshua declares, Lo b'shamayim hi, the Torah is not in heaven, but it's on earth. And it's seen as teaching us this fundamental truth. Actually, if we read the whole story, this theological or ideological side is almost secondary. Fundamentally, the story is trying to make a moral point, I would argue even a political point, about suffering, about the use of violence, different types of violence within the community, when it's justified, when it's not justified, and what the price is that we pay for violence even when it is justified. Now, in order to really understand this story, you have to see the context of the previous pages in the Gemara where it appears in Bava Metzia. The Mishnah there is talking about the concept of onat mamon, exploitation of people financially, either by forcing them to pay unreasonably high prices or forcing them to take unreasonably low prices, depending on what the economic setup is like. And this is a very technical area of halacha, of how you calculate the boundaries of acceptable pricing. But from there, the Mishnah goes on to talk about another form of ona'ah, another form of oppression. It talks about onat dvarim, oppression not with money, not with physical things, but with words. And that involves very often exploiting people's weaknesses by reminding them of things that they're uncomfortable with, or things of that sort, making them feel bad about themselves. And the Gemara quickly ratchets up and talks about an even more extreme form of onat dvarim, which is called hamalbin pnei chavero berabim, a person who literally causes the face to become white. In other words, he shames, he embarrasses his friend, his colleague, in public. And with this concept, this whole notion of onat dvarim moves from an interpersonal relationship or interpersonal issue to a larger social issue. It's not just the fact that someone has said something to another person, but they've done so in a context where there are other people around, within a social context. And the Gemara there compares Yehareg V'al Yavor to Shofech Damim, to literally spilling someone's blood. They say just as the blood drains from the person's face, it's like killing him. And they go even further, and they say that it's that's Yehareg V'al Yavor. They say that should be Malbin Pnei Chaver B'Rabim, to publicly embarrass, is really like murder, that you should rather die rather than do it. He even goes so far as to say you should rather suffer a slow, painful death rather than do this public shaming of someone. And then the Gemara goes on, and it talks about the prayer. It talks about how after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, all of the gates of prayer were closed, that God doesn't hear our prayers anymore like he used to. But there are a few exceptions. And one of the main exceptions is the gates of Ona'ah, the gates for the prayers of those who have been oppressed. Those prayers go straight to heaven and are heard by God and responded to. It also talks about Shari Dma'ot, the gates of tears, just that human suffering, pain, that still goes to God, and God still hears that, even if he doesn't receive prayers in general like he used to in the time of the Beit HaMikdash. Now, our story then begins, starts the technical debate from the Mishnah, Mishnah Kalim, about Hilchot Taharot, the laws of purity and impurity, and goes as follows. Tanan Hatam, Chachu Chuliot V'natan Chol Ben Chulia L'Chulia, Rabbi Elazar Netaher V'Chachamim Netamim. You make an oven, which is made out of sort of discs with a hole in the middle, sort of like donuts, made out of ceramic or made out of clay. And in between each one of these each one of these pieces of ceramic, you have they place dirt. Now, earthenware, pottery, is accepts tumah, can become tameh. This is one of the classic examples of something that can become tameh. Earth, on the other hand, plain earth, which has not been processed in that way, but it's just, and certainly if it's connected to the earth, cannot become tameh. It's too natural. It doesn't. It can't accept tumah. So now we have this this oven, which is nishtahin nishtaher. It's neither earthenware or earth. It's neither pottery nor dirt. So how do we consider this? What's its status? Which category does it fall into? So Rabbi Eliezer says that it has the status of the earth. And since it has the status of the earth, it has it is tahor, and it can never become tameh. But the Chachamim say no, it has the status of the earthenware, of the clay. And therefore it can become tameh. And since it becomes tameh, it it can become the entire vessel can become tameh. This entire oven can become tameh. And then the Mishnah goes on. This is still the Mishnah, and it says v'zehu tanur shel achnai. It says, and this is the tanur of achnai. Now, what does that line mean? What is tanur of achnai? What does that mean to us? So what if it's called achnai? They don't name most of the other objects in the Mishnah. But they give it a name. What does that mean? So Tosfot, right here on the daf, suggests what seems to be the simple pshat in the Mishnah, which is that achnai would have been understood in the times of the Mishnah as either a brand name or a model of a particular type of oven. In other words, it would have been understood to everyone. They explain this complicated type of oven, and then if you say, you know, like one of those things, it's like a Maytag, so then people understand what you're talking about. And it seems that what happens in later generations is people don't know these terms anymore, and therefore it becomes this very puzzling, mysterious phrase. Now, the later rabbis saw a different meaning here. And achna is a snake in Aramaic. So they ask, my achnai, I'm Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel, shekifu dvarim ka'achna zu vittim uhu. They surrounded it with words. Remember, we talk about onat dvarim. This is all about actions caused by words, not actions caused by actions. Or results caused by words, not by actions. And the earth, and this oven was surrounded by dispute. People talked around it, and like a snake wrapping itself around, and ultimately it was declared tameh, impure. So that's sort of one quick summary of the whole of the story of Tanuro Shel Achnai. It was debated, and eventually it became tameh. And in this very quick survey, it sounds like the point of this is that this is a very controversial oven. As you see, the rabbis disagreed about it. And it therefore has a name, has its own little place in the halachic literature. And it's called the Tanur Shel Achnai. But next, we get a further explication of what this Tanur is. Tana. The otol yom, hishiv Rabbi Eliezer, I call it shivot shaba olam. Below kiblu hemen. Amar lahan, im halacha kamoti charub ze yochiach, nekar charub mkoma mea ama, v'amrile arba meyot ama. Amrilo, ein mevi'in raya min hacharub. So first, what happens? On that day, Rabbi Eliezer answered all of their questions. He gave all the arguments in the world why this should be tahor, why this oven should be tahor, and he was rejected. And at this point, it seems quite sympathetic to Rabbi Eliezer. It sounds like he's really right. Like, there's no explanation as to why they reject his arguments. They just don't like it. They just don't want him. They don't give any answers. So he says, if the law is like me, let this carob tree prove my point. Let it show, let it side with me. And indeed, the carob tree was uprooted and went flying 100 or 400 amot through the air. Amrulo, Amy bin Rai Me Harub, they said, look, we don't take proof from this. These are rabbis. We take proof from arguments. We don't listen to carob trees. So he tries again. Chazar Amrulahem, Im Halacha Kamoti, Amat Hamayim Yochivim. If the law is like me, this channel of water, which is probably bringing either drinking water or irrigation water, should prove that I'm right. So the water went backwards, and the whole channel dried up. They said, we don't bring proofs from water and from water channels. We're not interested in all of your miracles. Now, what's going on here exactly? What's the significance of these rather strange actions by Rabbi Eliezer? There's a lot of discussion of the symbolism. Virtually everyone who comments, you know, has their own ideas. I think the best one that I've seen is that both the charuv, both the carob tree, and water, and the flow of water, are symbolic of the transmission of Torah. Now, Rabbi Eliezer is saying, Rabbi Eliezer, who is known as the arch-conservative, who received the old traditions exactly and perfectly, he's saying, if you reject this, you are cutting off the entire transmission of Torah. And you can't do that. Now, that's the symbolism that a lot of people suggest. But I think that the greatest significance of these actions, will become clearer as the story goes on, is not exactly what they do, but collectively, that these actions are extraordinarily destructive, but they're violent. You know, throughout the Tanakh, people give all sorts of wonders and signs that God is with them, but they don't necessarily, they don't in general. Okay, are we back on? Okay, we assume we're on. We don't find prophets doing destructive things. Here he's destroying things. He's ripping out trees. He's cutting off water supplies. And I think that ultimately this is about violence, about physical violence. Rabbi Eliezer believes that he has the right to use physical violence in order to prove his point. And why does he believe that? He believes that because he believes that he has the truth. He believes in the absolute truth which he holds, which is part of the world. It's as real as the trees and the water. It's part of the universe. And it's ordained and created by God no less than the trees and the water. And therefore, when he says, therefore, if people are going to reject it, violence is legitimate. We have to destroy things, because otherwise the whole world is going to be destroyed. There's too much at stake to worry about a couple of trees or some water flowing backwards. The important thing is to save the truth. It's to save God's word in the world. And there's no way, there's no budging, and there's no way around that. That, I believe, is Rabbi Eliezer's position. I always have the sense that Rabbi Eliezer is sort of like a superhero, throwing cars and trees and electric lines all around. There's something larger than life and superhuman about him, which only gets greater as the story goes on. I was looking for a picture of the Hulk, but Superman 1 will have to do for that. Chazar v'yamar lahem, im halacha kemoti, kotlei beit hamidrash yochichu. So now he says, if the halacha is like me, let the walls of this Beit Midrash collapse. He threw kotle Beit HaMidrash to pull, and the wall started to collapse. Ga'ar bahem Rabbi Yoshua amar lahem, im Talmidei Chachamim minatzkin zed halacha, atem matitchem. Talmidei Chacham are arguing about the halacha, what do you have to do with anything? Lo naflu b'nei kvodo shel Rabbi Yoshua, they did not fall because of the covet of Rabbi Yoshua, but they did not stand back up because of Rabbi Eliezer. Dayin matim v'omdim, they rather still stand on an angle. So Rabbi Eliezer now takes the next step. He's willing to not just destroy trees and water paths, but he's willing to destroy the Beit Midrash itself. He's willing to pull it down and kill everyone inside it, including himself. What I think is most reminiscent of is of Shimshon, another sort of superhero type figure, who pulls down the temple of the Plishtim on top of the Plishtim and upon himself. That's how far he's willing to go. He's willing to give his own life. The important thing for him is to save the truth, is to save the right halakha, the pure Torah as it is. Rabbi Yoshua, on the other hand, is a different position. He says that the Talmidei Chachamim are arguing, Menasim are conquering one another in halakha. What do you have to do with any of this? And now he makes clear why it is that he rejects the previous miracles as well. He says, because this has nothing to do with you. Argue that Rabbi Yoshua is saying this has nothing to do with you. This is about the Chachamim and their internal argument. It's not about absolute truth. It's about a socially constructed truth that the rabbis, through a majority rule, come to create. And if that's the case, then there's no room for physical violence because there's nothing to do with the physical world. There's no room. You have to attend to the social order. But we're not talking about an absolute reality. And what we see is that there seems to be an ultimate tension between these two approaches within the halakha and within the story. As the walls stay forever precariously tipped forwards, always ready to come crashing in, but always held up by Rabbi Yoshua, that there's this unresolved conflict between these two views of the halakha and these two views of life and these two views of violence. Now comes, I think, perhaps the most famous part. Chazav amar lahem, im halakha kamotim min hashamayim yochichu. He says, if the law is like me, let God himself prove it. How can you say that God has nothing to do with halakha? You can say that buildings and stone, wood and stone, and water have nothing to do with halakha. But God is the halakha. He created the halakha. So let him speak. Gastab akol v'amra, malachem etz Rabbi Eliezer, shalakha kamoto b'chol makom. He says, how dare you argue with Rabbi Eliezer? What's your problem? The halakha is always like him. He holds the truth. He knows the truth. He has the right answers, the absolute answers. But what does Rabbi Yoshua do? You think that he's beaten. Like, how do you argue with that? But he just gets up and he says, Amad Rabbi Yoshua alor aglav amar, lo bashamayim hi. It is not in heaven. And then he explains, my lo bashamayim hi. Amad Rabbi Yirmiyah shekfar nitna Torah meher sinu. Ein anu mashgichin bevat kol, shekfar katav bahar sinai batorah, acharei rabim lahatot. What does this mean? It means that the Torah is not in heaven, the Torah is already being given. It's true that the Torah has a divine basis, it's rooted in divine revelation, but its resolution, its future, is not in heavenly hands, they're in human hands. And it's humans who must continue to shape the Torah and to formulate and to interpret the Torah. And on what principle do they do it? On the principle, the heavenly principle of Acharei Rabim Lahatot. God has commanded us not to go after the absolute truth, but rather to follow the majority. But the majority must be followed. And that's what God wants from us. So, once again, it's a question of a social mechanism, of democracy, of a vote, that ultimately shapes the norms. Not a question of an absolute heavenly truth, whose significance here has been pushed to the side. There's a certain heavenly significance to the decision, but it's not because it's true, it's because it's authorized. Because God has given the rabbis the authority and the power to do this, which is very different from saying that they're right. So you said before, it's not a question of being right, it's a question of being final. Now comes the other off-quoted line. Ashikhir minatim aliyahu, amar lei, my avid kudush kudushabrihu bahushaita, amar lei kachiach viyamar nitzchune banai nitzchune banai. So there are various figures in the Talmud who occasionally have these meetings with Elijah. Sometimes he sees him appear in a dream. Sometimes you just sort of bump into him on the street. And Rabbi Natan bumped into him, and he said, what was God doing? Because Rabbi Eliyahu HaNavi's function in the Talmud, one of his main functions, is to give us the view from the other side, Me'achar HaPargod, to see the divine perspective, what's going on the heavenly stage while we're acting out events on the earthly stage. And what does God say? And what does he say? She said, he laughs and he says, my children have defeated me. My children have defeated me. My sons have defeated me here. This seems to embody this notion that God does not want people simply automaton, simply following his orders. Rather, he wants human beings to be creative. He wants human beings to figure things out for themselves. And ultimately, that might mean even turning against God, but that's what God wants. And he says it's like a mature parent who sees that his children are finally independent and is not upset, but is very happy about it. Now, that's the way this is normally read. And up to this point, I think it's without question the best reading. But the question was raised to me once, as we see, as the story goes on, I think it becomes more and more pertinent. What sort of laugh is this exactly? How can we tell? Is this really such a laugh of total joy? Or is there something else to it? Is it more of a chortle? Is there maybe a certain irony to this laughter? My children have defeated me. Oh, like my children think they've defeated me. Like a father who's allowed their kids to tackle him and let them think that they've tackled him and enjoying that game, but really knowing full well that it's all very silly. These children are tiny and could never do such a thing to him. And I think as the story goes on, you wonder if there's a certain distance or even cynicism to this laugh. Because as we'll see, it's not so clear who wins in the end, God or man. So, now starts the second part of the story, which rarely gets told. Amru. So the first thing they did is they took all of the objects that Rabbi Eliezer had declared tameh, tahor, and they burned them, declaring that they're not only tameh, but they can never become tahor. And it seems he can't possibly have done all of it. I mean, there's an infinite number of these objects. Rabbi Eliezer is just talking about a class of objects. So it seems to me that this is, once again, a symbolic act, a public act, a statement to the public, to the community, of Rabbi Eliezer's status, by showing, by publicly burning them. It's not like you actually burn all of them. Just like people now do symbolic book burnings, which are pretty much pointless now that we have virtual versions of texts. It used to be you could really destroy a book, but that doesn't work anymore, and so too here. It's a symbolic burning, like a burning of the flag. And then what do they do? And they took a vote, once again the importance of the vote, the majority rules, and they excommunicated him. Literally, they cursed him. They put him into Cheirim. And here, the tables turn. Here, it's no longer Rabbi Eliezer who's being violent and feels that he has a right to be violent. Rather, it is the rabbis who feel they have a right to be violent because their violence... Their violence is not a question of their violence is not a physical violence, but rather it's a social emotional violence. It's a violence of isolation. Everyone gets together and votes and decides we're not going to talk to him anymore. And that's precisely the sort of violence the rabbis were talking about previously in the Gemara, on the previous page of the Gemara that they're condemning, and they're trying to sensitize us to this. So what they're doing now is they're saying that this sort of social violence is justified precisely because what they're trying to do is create a community, create socially constructed norms out of the halacha, divinely sanctioned norms, rooted in God, but ultimately formulated by humans based on social consensus. And therefore, the response to someone who doesn't go along with the social consensus is not going to be physical violence, because it's not there, but rather it's going to be social violence. It's going to be pushing them out of the community and thereby hurting them emotionally. What's their immediate response after that? It says, "Amru mi yelech biyodiyo." Who's going to go and inform him? Now they have to go and inform him of this fact. There has to be this communication. It's sort of irony that they basically declare that no one's going to talk to him anymore, but now someone has to talk to him to tell them that they're not going to talk to him anymore. So Amar Lam Rabbi Akiva Anelech. Rabbi Akiva volunteers to go. Rabbi Akiva often is sort of a bridge figure, and he was, it seems, a Talmud of sorts of Rabbi Eliezer as well, so he had a relationship with him, which made him fit to do this job. And why does he want to do it? Shema yelech adam she'eino hagun v'yodio v'nimtza machriv et kol ha'olam kula. What's his concern? His concern that if this is not done properly, his delicate mission of informing Rabbi Eliezer properly, the entire world will be destroyed. So Rabbi Eliezer now goes from this sort of superhero type figure to this almost cosmic figure who has the capacity to destroy the entire world with his rage. And the concern is that he would really do such a thing, both because of his beliefs and because of his because of the pain that he's in. So how did Rabbi Akiva pull this off? He dressed all in black. And he stood 4 amot away, as one would do for someone who is in chayrim, someone who is excommunicated. Amar lo, Rabbi Akiva, Amar lo, Rabbi Eliezer. Okay, wait, someone's playing with this now. Please stop playing with that. Please stop scrolling. Okay, thank you. And he sits for Rabbi Eliezer, acting as if, and Rabbi Eliezer realizes there's something wrong. Amar lo Rabbi Eliezer, Akiva, ma yomi yomayim. What's going on? What's going on? Amar lo Rabbi, kineduak mali shechaverim bedilin imcha. And he says in the most gentle way possible, Rabbi, it seems to me that your friends, which is a little ironic, have separated themselves from you. Afu kara begadav v'chalatz min alav v'nishmat yashav al gabei karka. So he responds in the appropriate halachic way, which is to go into mourning for oneself, as it were. If it's not scrolling, we should be on page 8, I guess. I guess just give people page numbers, let them scroll if that's not working. And he says, and what he does is he does exactly as a person does when they go into Avelut, when they go into mourning. He tears his clothing, he takes off his shoes, he sits on the ground. But then something else happens. It's not just the external form of mourning that he goes into, but the internal action of mourning, the internal form of mourning. So going out to the tears come streaming from his eyes. And Rabbi Eliezer is just devastated by this treatment, and by this impact, and by this marginalization. And what actually happens when he's, what's the actual impact on the world? Just then, lakar olam shlish b'zeitim, v'shlish b'zeitim, v'shlish b'se'arim. So first of all, the world is devastated with in its crops. The olives, wheat, barley, they all take huge hits. The markets crash, as it were. And clearly he takes out his anger and his pain and suffering upon the entire world. Some say that even the dough in the woman's hand swelled up, it went bad. Now, why is this, it seems relatively marginal compared to these huge crop failures. But I think what's happening is, we'll see this happen again in the later part of the story, is that we're turning now from the public sphere to the private sphere, to the male sphere of the farm, of the fields, of the markets, to this female sphere of the home, of the dough, of the baking. And the notion that his response impacted not just the public sphere, but also the private, the inner sphere, which is precisely what Rabbi Eliezer is suffering, where Rabbi Eliezer is suffering. Therefore, it even goes into people's houses and destroys their meals, not just the larger picture. Tana, ach gadol ya ba'oto ayom, shebechol makom shatan lo, v'yatan bo einav, Rabbi Eliezer nisrach. And then furthermore, everywhere Rabbi Eliezer looks was destroyed. Once again, this notion of just fiery rage coming out and destroying, violently destroying everything in sight. Of course, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai does something similar when he comes out of the cave, according to the Gemara and Shabbos. But everything is destroyed. So this notion of this horrific, violent response, which no one is safe from. This is the danger, as I said, of scorning a great rabbi. But now the story takes an interesting turn, and a new character appears. Avraham Gamliel haya baba sfina. And even Reuben Gamaliel was going on a ship. There are lots of stories of Reuben Gamaliel going on his ships, sort of a whole little genre of stories. Reuben Gamaliel, but what happened now? Amad alav nachshol v'tavo. A great wave came to drown him. There's almost something monstrous about the sea rising up against Reuben Gamaliel. Amar kinedum elish einza ela b'shvil Rabbi Elazar and Horkins. Says, it seems to me that this must could only be happening because of Rabbi Elazar ben Horkins. Now, it's interesting. Why is the focus on Rabbi Gamliel? He hasn't even appeared in the story. If we had to blame someone, if someone had to take the hit, I would say it would have to be Rabbi Yoshua. Now, it's possible to suggest that this actually reflects a certain lack of smoothness in the story, that these stories are pulled together and weaved together and don't necessarily have this sort of smoothness. Just like a sugi doesn't always have the sort of smoothness that you would expect from a poem, these stories don't always have the sort of smoothness that you would expect from a novel or a modern short story. But clearly, Reuben Gamliel makes sense because Reuben Gamliel is the Parnas Hador. He is the leader. He is the Nasi. And he has to, the buck stops with him. He's going to have to take responsibility. And anything that was done was ultimately done on his behalf. What does he do? Amar al raglav, amar. Ribono shel olam. Galud yadu lefanecha shelo lechvodi asiti, lo lechvod beit Abba asiti, ela lechvodcha shelo yirbu machloket b'Yisrael. Nachayam nizapo. So he gets up and he turns to God and he says, I didn't do this for my own sake. We saw from the previous stories about Reuben Gamliel, there's always this suspicion that he's taking these high-handed, aggressive actions because they benefit him. He's in favor of rabbinic authority, but he is rabbinic authority. So there's something of a conflict of interest here. How could he do that? And even if it's not personal, it's because of his need to establish the institution of the Nasi, this line of his that goes back from with his back to his fathers, and we'll go forward to Rabbi Yehuda Nasi and much later. It's his responsibility to his family. So, but even that is a form of egotism. But rather, no, he said, I did this l'shem shamayim, quite literally. I did it for the honor of God. Shelo yirbu machloket b'Yisrael. That there shouldn't be further machloket. Once again, this among the Jews. The Jews need to be cohesive, and cohesive means they need a social structure. It means the decisions have to be made by consensus, not based on someone claiming they have the truth and then throwing everything at everyone when they don't get their way. The people of the world can't work that way, and the people of Israel can't work that way. And I did this with the most pure motives, even though, yes, it's true that I benefited from this. Now, it would seem at this point that now we get what's sort of happening. Why is there such a violent response? It's not that what they did was wrong in excommunicating Rabbi Eliezer, but rather God allowed all this destruction to happen because it was might have been the right thing in principle, but people had wrong motivations. This is something that we see in several places, most famously perhaps in the story of Shaul and Amalek, where it's been argued that his mistake was that he didn't kill the Amalekim lishma. He didn't kill them because he was supposed to kill them, because it was a mitzvah. He killed them like a regular war to get booty and to destroy them for his own greater glory. And as a result of that, all of his killing didn't fulfill the mitzvah. It was just killing. That's why he was punished. So to hear, there's this sense that if you don't have the right intent, that when you do acts of violence, violence that's done l'shem shamayim can't just be done like anything else. It's not okay to do it shelo lishma. It has to be done lishma, because if not, it's violence. It's wrong. It's brutal. And therefore, that was the concern, only because Reuben Gamliel was able to stand up and make this declaration that the violence was stopped. And it would seem that that he was right, that it was true, he really was. But had he been wrong, then there wouldn't have been a price. But since everything was done properly, al tarat hakodesh, so it seems that the sea subsides, that God takes this as an argument, and just no longer responds to Rabbi Eliezer's cries of pain. But it gets more complicated than that. This is the last section, I think the most powerful section of the story. Once again, we turn to the world of women. Ima shalom debatayud Rabbi Eliezer, achte Rabbi Gamliel. all of a sudden we learn that Ima Shalom, who was the wife of Rabbi Eliezer, was also the sister of Rabbi Gamliel. In other words, Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Eliezer weren't just colleagues, they were brothers-in-law. And therefore, all of these political events and social events, once again, as we saw before with the dough, have their way of making their way back into the domestic world, because there are all these complicated interrelationships. And it's not just when Rabbi Akiva puts, when Rabbi Gamliel puts Rabbi Eliezer in Cherem, he's putting his own sister in a terrible position. And that is, and that is what we see. Ima Shalom is torn between her brother and her husband. And she has to find a place, the ability to make shalom. She wants to be the peacemaker. What happened? What happened? From that day on, she never allowed Rabbi Eliezer to say tachnun, to fall on his face. Because if he ever were to fall on his face and truly pour out his heart to God, then Rabbi Gamliel would certainly die. In other words, what she understands is that this violence has a price, even if it's done with the best of intentions, even if it's done for the best of reasons, even if you had no choice whatsoever but to do it, and you didn't want to do it, the violence, the social violence, the emotional pain is going to come back with a price, and a price in the physical world, in physical violence. What happened, though? So according to one version, one day it was Rosh Chodesh, but she got confused between whether or not it was a Malei or a Chaser, a 29 or a 30-day month. Now this is, of course, sort of interesting, because previously we argued that in the time of Rabban Gamliel, there was no fixed calendar, and there was nothing to get confused about. It wasn't just like, oh, I forgot how many days Iyar has. She, you had to find out. So it's interesting. So this story seems to assume rather a fixed calendar of a later time. So that's one possibility. And therefore, she didn't prevent him from saying Tachnun. Or, I think a much more dramatic possibility, Ika da Amri, Ata Anya Vakaya Baba. A poor person comes and knocks on the door. Now, once again, she's torn betwixt and between. She has to keep an eye on her husband in order to keep her brother safe. But on the other hand, she has a more universal moral obligation to the poor person at the door. What does she take care of? Her own household or the person in the street? And she tries desperately to be in two places at once. Afkele Rivka. So she runs and gives... She comes and brings the man bread. She has no choice. She has to. He's right there. She has an immediate moral concern. And she runs back. And what happens? Ashkeche denafal al anpe. She finds her husband falling on his face. It's very beautiful, sort of cinematic sort of image. You sort of see with her as she's running in, hoping to see him still saying Shimon Esrei. And she runs into the room and finds him flat on the ground. Amarle, kum, katlit la'achi. Get up. You have just killed my brother. So getting up and going down, he falls down on his face. From Gamliel dies, he stands up. And he says, it's all over. You just killed my brother. Adahachi nafik shikorim vet Rabban Gamliel v'shchiv. And just then, a shofar came from Rabban Gamliel's house, and... to announce from Gamliel had died. sort of reminds me of the cars that go around some neighbors of Yerushalayim with loudspeakers announcing details of funerals, and that's how people find things out. But I can never understand what they're saying, it's so blurred. But the announcement comes out instantaneously. There's immediate impact. So Rabbi Eliezer says, the interesting thing is Rabbi Eliezer now, it turns out, doesn't really understand what's been going on. He's been acting much more on instinct, on emotion, and he hasn't really understood the implications of what he's doing and all of his crying out and all of his suffering. Amar le mina yada. How do you know that? How could you possibly know that your brother was going to die right now? I mean, you know, okay, but I pray, but how do you know it's going to happen so immediately? How could you, are you a prophet? Amar la, kach mikublani mi beit avi abba. She quotes a misorah from who? From Rabbi Gamliel the first, Rabbi Gamliel's grandfather, Rabbi Gamliel Hazaken, from the times of the Beis HaMikdash, that they understood this, that their family understands this, even as they take the other path. That kol ha-sharim nin alin chutz mishare ona'a. All of the gates, as the Gemara said previously, all the gates of prayer have been sealed since the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, except for the gates of ona'a, except for the prayers of those who suffer from affliction, from oppression, from the hands of other people. So what we learn here is that violence, social and physical, even when justified, always has a price. And that Rabbi Gamliel essentially dies to protect the system. He had no choice but to put Rabbi Eliezer on Chayrin. But he also knew the teaching. It seems that he might have known this was going to happen. He knew the teaching of his grandfather, or must have known, that there's always a price, that if you cause someone to suffer, their prayers will be answered. Even if they were put in Chayrim or they were otherwise tortured for good reason, there's always going to be a price. Violence always comes around. And there's no real resolution. I think this is what's typical of the really rich rabbinic stories, particularly in the Gemara, that there's no full resolution. There's no siding with one view of halacha or the other. Is halacha about absolute truth, or is halacha about social, relative truth? Is it, when is violence justified to protect the truth, physical violence, or is it more social violence that's justified to protect the community? There's no resolution ultimately. There's no simple person getting up, as Rabbi Yehoshua does in the middle of the story, declare the Torah is not in heaven. That can only happen in the middle of the story. But by the end of the story, everything is in conflict with each other. We don't know which way to go, which direction is ultimately proper. Now, it seems pretty clear that the rabbis feel the absolute necessity of maintaining this world, maintaining the halakha, maintaining the social halakha in which there's consensus, and maintaining a community of halakha. But there doesn't seem to be any way to get rid of Rabbi Eliezer. So they're always going to be there. They're always going to know the real truth. They're always going to threaten to bring down the entire Beit Midrash. And ultimately, people are going to die as a result of this whole process, of this battle of Torah, which gets described earlier in the story. Minatskin said that the Talmid Chachamim are in battle with each other, that lives are at stake. Because ultimately, even just social things have tremendous import and tremendous emotional and ultimately human impact. Okay. Are there any questions? No? Oh, just scroll up. Okay, I guess we'll call it then. Okay, thank you very much. Next week we'll be doing the story of a not well-known story at all from the Masechet Yevamot, and not well-learned Masechet at all, about Rav Yosef ben Hyrcanus. We saw him as a bit character in a previous story, but this is really going to be his day, where he's really the leading man. And how he interacts with the other rabbis. And once again, we're going to see this clash between different worldviews, different understandings of Torah, and different understandings of how to enforce things within the world of Torah. Yes, Yisrael, can you talk more about? Yeah, I mean, the notion of God being sarcastic would be interesting. I'm not sure that you can... It would be interesting to go through Chazal and see if there are any places where you could really show that God can say such things. And I'm not really saying that he necessarily is. What I'm saying is that the text is somewhat open. And in retrospect, when we read the whole story, it seems that his children have not conquered him at all. Rabbi Gamliel lays dead. The world is in ruins. So I don't know how. So in context of the whole story, God's statement sounds a little funny. And so what we also have to ask is, precisely because of this, is how do you have a story with God's voice in it? Because doesn't God's voice flatten out all the other voices? And suggesting that God's voice here is ambiguous, purposely ambiguous, because God's voice is never fully understandable, is exactly what allows these other voices to float around. We have to ask, in other words, what does it mean when he gets up? Who's talking in the bakol? Maybe it's God contradicting himself? Is this a game? It's all not terribly clear. Yeah. When he says, my children, what about the wife as peacemaker between the two? What about it? I mean, I think Rish Lakish also suffers and dies based on these sorts of things. Correct. Rish Lakish also is insulted and ultimately dies. And this is, once again, this Chazal's huge sensitivity to shame. Professor Jeffrey Rubinstein at NYU has written a lot about the role of shame in the whole world of the Bavli, and this is his ultimate concern, and what it does to people, and how it can be absolutely devastating. And Reish Lakish, that is exactly an example of Onat Dvarim, and the story definitely fits in with the same sort of motifs.
Awesome. Reish Lakish's wife also tried to make peace between the two rabbis.
Yes, and something that was pointed out I was reading recently mentions this tendency for, in the Bavli, for all sorts of figures to suddenly become related to each other, these main characters. It's sort of part of this phenomenon. We don't see any reference to these relationships in earlier sources or in sources from Eretz Yisrael. But in the Bavli, you very much have that. And the notion of women as moving between between and trying to hold together and keep the peace, I think is quite common. Any more questions? If there are no more questions, then I guess that's it. We'll see you all next week. Very good. Okay, thanks a lot.